Welcome to Should I Love This Comic? Hello, my name is Damien Drouet-Whiter, and with me I have...
And my name is Irigail Drouet-Whiter.
We're here for a new episode of our podcast, Should I Love This Comic?, where we look at a comic book from my collection and decide whether or not I am right to love it. And today we're looking at a reprint comic. It's Marvel Tales issue 220. It had a cover date of February 1989, but it was on sale on the 18th of October 1988 when I was 14. So, I looked at that date, what was happening on that date, and that was the date that apparently that week in UK history, the government banned interviews with the IRA and Sinn Féin. You remember that, where they used to get actors to do the voices?
They did, and some quite famous people used to do the
voices. Who used to do it? It was famous.
I can't remember now, but...
No, I don't know either.
But yeah, they used to have lots of...
So that's me attempting to add a bit of real life history to help us remember... Because 1988 is a long time ago now, isn't it?
I was not even born.
No, you I was 14, which means you were 13.
13, yes.
Yes, because this is it was released in October, so by that point in the year we both had our birthdays.
We should show people photos of ourselves.
Of what we looked like when we were 14 and 13. Yeah. I don't know if I've got any photos of me age 14.
Probably not. Here.
Yeah, my mum probably has some, but anyway. And as well as looking at what happened in real life history, I've also looked at what happened in comics. So I thought I'd mention a few comics that came up at the same time for comics fans who are listening. The same month as this comic came out came Alpha Flight 67, which is a significant one when we talk about this comic, because this comic is a reprint of a comic written by a writer called Bill Mantlow. And he left comics in 1989, and his last comic for Marvel before he left comics was Alpha Flight number 66. So the same month this is released, his last new work for Marvel was published, or the month before. It was also the month that West Coast Avengers 41 was released, which again... Comics fans may know is the first issue of West Coast Avengers that's not drawn by Al Milgram, who draws this comic. So we're talking about two people who were like big names, done lots of work, and this comes immediately after they'd left like their last big work as writer and as penciler for Al Milgram. He does loads more work for Marvel, but he moves to being inker instead. It was also the same month that Invasion First Strike was being published by DC, which was the first and only thing that Bill Mantlo ever did for DC just before he left. At that time, it was while Inferno was the crossover that was going on in Marvel, and there's adverts to do with that in there. So it's coming out in 1988. Now, the weird thing, though, is it's a reprint comic. So it's coming out in 1988, but it's not from 1988. Ah. It's a reprint of a comic called Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man 81, which had a cover date of August 1983 and was on sale on the 17th of May 1983. So in 1983, well, I would be 9, but at the point this was released, I would have been 8, because it's in May, which is before my birthday, before your birthday, and you would have been 7 when this was released.
Indeed.
I have some little facts about that. Shall I go through them for the
listeners? What's 1983?
Well, 1983, the thing that happened on the same week, which kind of slightly links to what we discussed last time, is that two different scientific groups reported that they'd found a link between a virus and the illness AIDS.
Oh.
So it's basically the discovery of HIV. The two different scientific groups apparently called it different things. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later it was called HIV, but effectively they found HIV. Oh. So they'd had AIDS for a few years and they... So this came out on the same week as that, which could be linked because there's drug use in this.
There is.
And in
not
comics...
All, but not everybody who has HIV is a druggie.
Indeed.
Children.
Obviously. And in comics, there are a couple of big number ones the same month, which was Alpha Flight number one. first issue of Alpha Flight, which is a big deal for Marvel. And for DC, there was a big first issue, which was Batman and the Outsiders, number one. Mm-hmm. So two big series of the 80s that were considered, they were kind of bestsellers of the 80s, particularly when they launched. Both of them kind of tapered off quite quickly. They both came out that same week as Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, number 81. Having said this is a reprint that I bought in 88 when I was 14. That actually originally the story had come out when I was
seven.
There's another story to this. When I was eight, not seven. Eight. I'm getting that wrong. And I can't do simple maths.
And I was seven.
There was another story to this. And that is that this same comic was reprinted in a Marvel UK title called Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. And it appeared in issues 554 and 555, which were dated the 19th of October and the 26th of October 1983. So by that point we were nine, that few months later, I was nine, Erigail was eight. And that was where I first read this story. Now I switched to reading as my weekly comic. I used to get a Marvel UK weekly every week. And my mum let me pick which one it was. And I switched to Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends from its first issue, which wasn't number one, it was 553, because they changed the numbering from Spider-Man. And 554 and 555 reprinted this story. Now, I bought this for a completely different reason. It was 1988. I was buying as many comics as I could get my hands on. It was a Spider-Man book. It had Cloak and Dagger in it. I could see that from the cover, and I'd been reading their books and enjoying it. So I bought it for that. And then when I read it, I thought, wait a minute, I've read this before. Now, I don't have those Marvel UK comics from back then. But I knew this story immediately, and this is why this is a comic that I love. Because it reminds me of that first, I mean, literally, the second Spider-Man story I read. The first one was in 553 of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, which actually reprinted. There was a US comic that was called Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends and had the characters from the cartoon in. And then they republished this one. And just to give an idea of what Marvel UK was doing at the same time, Daredevil's number 10 was out, which had the Alan Moore and Alan Davis Captain Britain, which we talked about last time. And Doctor Who Monthly was on issue 81, which was written by Steve Parkhouse, who we talked about last time. So it's all kind of linking. I had a look at the comic that I went to after Spider-Man, which I went to Return of the Jedi Weekly, which at that point was on issues 18 and 19. And apparently if you got issue 18, you got a poster of Boba Fett. So that's quite exciting. And the one that I'd been reading previously was called Thor and the X-Men. And at the point that this was released, it was reprinting Thor issue 227 from 1974, which was by Jerry Conway and Rich Buckler, and X-Men 23 from 1966 by Roy Thomas and Werner Roth. So that was what I had been reading, and I switched over to Spider-Man with this story. You feel the day is real. Through the story, it is Stalkers in the Shadows. The writer is Bill Mantlow. The penciler is Al Milgram. The inker is Jim Mooney, although as penciler and inker it is actually listed as artists. So my suspicion would be that it was more of a layouts finishes, which we talked about a bit before in previous episodes. The letterer was Joe Rosen, the colourist was Bob Sharon, and the editor was Tom DeFalco. And this one had cover art by Mike Zeck. So I want you to start by having a little chat about the cover.
Yeah.
So what did you think of this cover when you look at it? What was your reaction to it?
My reaction to it is, let me take my faraway glasses off, was that I really liked it. I was, this is going to go all a bit wrong, a bit Pete Tong as we say in the UK. My first reaction was, I wonder if the person in the middle is Grace Jones in a cloak. Because it looks a bit cheek bony.
Yeah, yeah, Cloak is a black guy, he's got the big cheekbones. Me. But actually, from that picture, there's nothing that gives off whether he's male or female.
No, no,
you
exactly.
just see half a face and the outline of the cloak. That's the way it's drawn. So... obviously, if you go to our little mini website, our blogspot, which is shouldilovethis.blogspot.com, I will have a gallery post that will show you this picture by Mike Zeck.
So I didn't know who Cloak and Dagger were, and I didn't know who the Punisher was, and I knew who Spider-Man was, because you'd have to be under a rock to not know who that was. Yeah, and I like, sort of like artistically, I think it's quite, it's well designed.
Yeah.
There's a kind of, it's not confusing, because you've got like two halves of colour, you've got like the brown at the top, predominantly black at the bottom. You can do a you can do a vertical line straight through the middle, where on one side you've got split by Cloak, then on one side you've got the good person, and on the other side you've got the bad person. And yeah, so like I think it's...
I mean, the design's definitely balanced, as you say. Cloak is dead central. Mm-hmm. Spider-Man and Punisher are either side coming out of his cloak. So mm-hmm. they've made the blue of Spider-Man's costume look black. And obviously the background of Punisher's costume is black. So that's all coming out of the black cloak. Over Cloak's shoulder, you can see Daredevil? Dagger. Can see Dagger kind of dropping in.
Yeah.
And... where she is kind of balances where the corner box is on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a very well balanced cover. There's some very unusual things about it. I think brown background is very unusual for Marvel Comics of the 80s. That was not a colour that was often used.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I presume it's because they're trying to keep this kind of dark feel. Mm-hmm. They want Dagger, who's dressed in white, to really pop. So you need a dark colour behind that. They've definitely tried to make the key character, I think, or very prominent character at the front, the Punisher. Now, one thing that's interesting about this is this says Marvel Tales starring Spider-Man, guest starring the Punisher and Cloak and Dagger. And then it's got the name of the comic, Stalkers on the Shadows, written on it. It says guest starring the Punisher, Cloak and Dagger. The Punisher is not mentioned on the original cover. At this point in time, and I'd read a few of them, Marvel Tales was going through, in order, reprinting every single appearance of the Punisher. Because the Punisher had a relatively new series at the time that was doing incredibly well. He was like a huge breakout character by about 88, which is when this was published.
Mm-hmm.
He'd really come to the fore, starting with the limited series, I think that was in 85 or 86, around that era, which was drawn by this artist, Mike Zeck.
Mm.
And they'd been reprinting every story, because he first appeared in Spider-Man, in order. And this particular issue obviously also featured Cloak and Dagger. But I wanted to show Irigel. Now, I can only show this on my phone, so it's quite small, but show him the original covers.
Oh, okay.
So we could do a comparison. So that is the original cover, which again, I will put on the website.
Yeah.
Which, no mention of the Punisher at all.
No.
It's a Cloak and Dagger image. And what do you think of that comparative? The original cover on art was by Al Milgram, who's the artist of the comic, and did a lot of particularly early 80s covers for Marvel.
It's less... it gives away less of the story, maybe, I think.
Possibly. It's definitely... I don't know, in some ways it's very similar. Cloak has a very, very similar positioning on the cover to both covers, both the original
Absolutely.
And the new one.
Holding up
The difference in this one is, because the Punisher's not there, where there was a character either side of Cloak's body. Mm. In this case, one side it's Dagger, one side it's Spider-Man. And the other thing that Al Milgram has done is he's been more literal in his depiction of Cloak. You can actually see Cloak's legs at the bottom. You can see how he's formed within it. Oh, you can slightly in the original, but I don't think quite so obviously.
This bit's all a bit around here it's all a bit messy, isn't it? A bit
confusing, yeah. And the other thing they've done is with the background.
What that is, I suppose that's the gun holder for...
Yeah.
But his leg.
Yeah.
It all goes a bit wrong.
But in some ways, that original cover's much simpler and much clearer.
Mm, maybe.
But I think, you know, a lot of people would say, and definitely, you know, I think for many people, Mike Zeck is a better artist.
Mm. Maybe.
The thing I really didn't like on the Mike Zeck cover, though, is how he draws Dagger. I think Dagger's very cartoony, and she's got an exceptionally small waist. I mean, she has on both covers.
Yes.
But the newer, the reprint cover, I think it is particularly... She's kind of over-sexualised, I think. I mean, she's very sexualised in both.
Yeah.
Dagger's original costume is very sexy. But I think... It's a bit over the top on the second one.
Is that supposed to be a necklace?
That is a necklace that hangs. Oh, okay. Well, it's attached to the costume.
Okay.
So it looks more like a necklace actually on the new cover.
Oh, yeah.
But it is attached to the costume.
And does it have...
I mean, the other thing that we can definitely say is the original cover, it's more clear that Cloak is a man.
Yeah.
Whereas you said he's quite androgynous on the new cover.
Yeah.
Now, what I want to show you next... It's the covers I saw. I talked about the two Marvel UK comics. So the first one, if I can find it, is that one. That would be interesting. So that's Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends issue. I've forgotten what it was. 554, did I say? Mm. This was silly, wasn't it? I've lost it already.
Fantastic Four.
Issue 554.
Okay.
So that is a much more simple cover. I'm going to put it on. You would have no idea what was in this comic.
Mm.
It's a very simple picture of Spider-Man, but it does say free magic flyer, and it came with a big plastic circular thing that was like a... kind of like a frisbee, but with a hole in the middle that you could throw.
I remember that.
So, obviously, that was the thing. Marvel UK were big ones for free gifts. So it's worth having a look at that. When you get it. As I recall, I lost that very quickly. I threw it somewhere and never found it again. Yes, and you could also win one of 5 badge radios. Marvel UK Comics also would have a lot of text on the cover. And I also want to show you the second part of that.
Okay.
Which uses the same image by Al Milgram, but removes the detail in the background. Again, this is going to be in our gallery post. I'd recommend looking and comparing. And they change the background colour and they recolour the characters as well. They do it quite differently.
Mm.
Really interesting. And there's also the fact that you get a free gift of 3 stickers, which have Captain America, Spider-Man and Doctor Strange on them. And you can win a Spidey transfer set. I mean, how exciting was Marvel UK Comics?
Mm.
It was always free gifts in English comics, wasn't it? Did you ever get any English comics, really?
No,
they always had free gifts whenever they launched anything new. And actually, I should say, you know, I started reading Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends and given up on Thor and the X-Men. This was because they had TV adverts for that comic. You know, encouraging you to buy Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. And I'd seen the cartoon. And I was like, well, I have to get that. I have to stop buying Thor and the X-Men. That was obviously not the plan. They probably would have preferred me to buy Thor and the X-Men and Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
Do you think with this one, this makes great a podcasting.
So that's the first of the two Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends ones, the one with the magic flyer.
Do you think that's more towards the animation?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
I think it's got more of an animation look towards... I think that's not computer drawn, because I don't think they could have
they
done that.
Yeah, they couldn't.
But it looks more clean
Yeah, yeah, it's very simple. I mean, to be honest, it's designs that you notice the free gift more than the picture, I think.
Yeah.
But also the linkage to the animation style.
Yeah.
Whereas, obviously, then when we get to the second part, which reuses the US cover, it's much more about just showing off, you know, reusing what's already there.
Mm.
Okay, so that's the cover. Which one is your favourite of the you know, if we were to say favourite cover, which one's your favourite? Including the reprint.
I know which one isn't my favourite, that one.
Obviously, the one that's with the free flyer, the free rubbish flyer one. As a cover. Although the free flyer was really cool and it did fly really well.
Ah.
And I was rubbish at throwing frisbee things. It was actually quite a good free gift. So do you prefer this cover? Or
yes.
Do you prefer the Mike Zeck or the Al Milgram?
See, I think that's a lot more modern than this. I think this is quite... It's quite 60s, 70s with a kind of a...
Yeah, Al Milgram did tend towards...
Whirling.
Being quite a classic artist. Yeah, classic Marvel. Whirlwind. And he was probably a bit of a throwback. I think that's why he...
Whirlwind in the background.
He fell from fashion in the 80s.
I think the one that we've got, it's kind of got... it's asking you... asking you to question things more.
Yeah.
I think sort of like all of
Spider-Man's got his pain, spider sense going.
Pain thing, or so you know, all the little lines that
that's a spider sense, you know, where you can sense danger.
The spider sense possibly going, or pain or whatever, sort of like not sure what's going on there. Then you've got the Punisher looking at Spider-Man with kind of malevolence, and then so to cut a long story short, then you've kind of got
so do you prefer that Mike Zeck one? Is that your favourite?
Yeah, so basically it's kind of bringing you in to the story, and also has relevance to once you've read the story that you know what the cover is alluding to, because sometimes you don't always know what the cover alludes to. So the cover has...
I think you could say that. I mean, I personally prefer the Al Milgram cover, but I'm a big Al Milgram fan.
Okay.
Much more than the average person, and we'll talk a bit about that when I go over his credits. He is somebody whose stuff I love, and I'm sure these comics are part of it. The fact that I saw these UK reprints when I was very young. You know, we're talking about me being 8 years old.
The Whirlwind one.
That is quite young, whereas I was 14 when I saw this. And I look at this and I go, oh, that's a great cover. It's really well drawn. Mm. There's a part of me, isn't somebody analysing, who goes, that's better drawn than the Al Milgram. But the Al Milgram gets me more, I think, because of my connection to that version of the characters.
Mm.
And I just love... You know, one thing I find with Al Milgram, I think everything's angles and it's all going off and it's a bit crazy and it's not thought through always. It always looks like he's done it really quickly. And I like that element of it being a bit chaotic, you know, the legs and the arms are not necessarily... Whereas I think, you know, Mike Zeck, I think he looks at people and how their bodies move a lot of the time. I mean, less so with the Dagger character, but with the male characters, definitely.
Yeah, sort of like, and also with the concentric circles in the previous one.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that probably helps to kind of make...
Well, that draws attention to her powers as well. It draws attention to Dagger.
Right, okay.
You know, and again, that might be part of the reason I prefer that other cover.
Mm.
Because I'm a bigger fan of Cloak and Dagger than I am of The Punisher, because of various other stories I've read over the years.
Okay.
So the original cover by Al Milgram shows off Cloak and Dagger more, and this one shows off Spider-Man and Punisher more.
Mm. Mm.
You know. Make me feel like I can make it real. You got me hooked, keeping me on the floor. If I'm a tease and you're the love, please, I want more. Never had you right as delicate and fine. let's move on from that. And what I normally do and what I'm going to do today is go over the people who were involved in making this comic. Okay. So let's have a look at who created this comic. And this is the bit where I then talk for 5 years. So, you know, if you need the toilet, stop it and go now. Bill Mantlow was one of the most prolific Marvel writers of the 70s and 80s. Tragically, he was struck by a car while rollerblading in 1992 and suffered severe head trauma. To this day, his daily activities are severely curtailed and he resides in a healthcare facility where he received full-time care. This tragic accident means that unlike most of the creators who we spotlight on the show, we do not have Bill Mantlow's own account of his comics career. This means his legacy is often shaped by other people's recollections, which will sometimes paint him unfavourably. Mantlow entered comics in 1974, so the year I was born, initially gaining work as a colourist. His first writing appeared in Deadly Hands of Kung Fu. This was one of the black and white magazines that Marvel published in the 70s. In this book, he co-created Marvel's first Hispanic hero, White Tiger, with the artist George Perez, which ran through the rest of that series from number 7 on. In the 1970s, Marvel Comics was plagued with what they called the dreaded deadline doom. So books would often ship late or miss shipping due to lateness, which caused Marvel to regularly take on extra costs from the printers and the distributors. The editor-in-chief at the time, Marv Wolfman, decided to create a fill-in title so that there were stories ready to be slotted in if a book ran late. Bill Mantlow was assigned to this theoretical book and wrote stories for almost every Marvel book in this era. He soon gained a number of regular assignments, starting with Iron Man, then he moved on to Champions, Spectacular Spider-Man, Human Fly, Man from Atlantis, etc. He did loads of work. He's probably most famous, though, for two toy tie-in books from the 80s, which he wrote for a long time, ROM Space Knight and the Micronauts. Micronauts was based on the Mego action figures and began because Bill Mantlow's son, Adam, received some of the toys for Christmas 1977. He found himself creating stories around the toys and approached the editor-in-chief of the time, who was Jim Shooter, to get the license to produce a comic of Micronauts. Mantlow wrote Micronauts numbers 1 to 58, which ran from September 78 to January 1984. ROM Space Knight was another action figure, this time created by the Parker Brothers Toy Company. They approached Marvel about setting up a licensed comic that would develop the characters and his world. Mantlow wrote all 75 issues of ROM from September 79 to November 85, working principally with artist Sal Buscema, who we were talking about last time. Mm-hmm. No, that was the one before last, wasn't it? The Thor one. Many of the concepts Mantlow introduced in ROM have become parts of the Marvel mythos. In fact, one of the swords in the current X-Men crossover, which is called X of Swords, is from ROM's home planet. So things that he introduced back in those comics in the 70s and 80s still being used today. Mantlow's most impactful run at Marvel was on Incredible Hulk. He wrote the book from issue 245, which was December 1979, until issue 313, which was August 1985, so basically 5 years. His editor, Al Milgram, who is the artist on this book, encouraged him to try new things, and the run is effectively one long story, where the Hulk first gains the intellect of Bruce Banner and then slowly loses it, culminating in a huge battle in Incredible Hulk 300, which features Hulk versus the Marvel Universe. And I would say, anyone out there who hasn't read that, it's all on Marvel Unlimited, every issue of Hulk is, read that run. It's really good. He also used Hulk to bring back a minor character who he co-created with artist Keith Giffen in Marvel Preview number 7 from 1976. Rocket Raccoon would then receive a mini-series written by Mantlow and drawn by a newcomer called Mike Mignola, who became a huge star. This 1985 series was the inspiration for Rocket's inclusion in the relaunch of Guardians of the Galaxy that came with the 2006 Annihilation series. I can't say Annihilation. Not without really pausing. Rocket Raccoon's involvement in the Guardians of the Galaxy movies makes him the most famous of Bill Mantlow's creations. We've seen him, haven't we? You remember Rocket Raccoon?
Yeah, we do.
In Guardians of the Galaxy. During Mantlow's Hulk run, there were two instances of him being accused of plagiarism. The first was in relation to Hulk 286 from 83. Manklow based the plot on an episode of the TV show Outer Limits from 1964. This was based on a short story by writer Harlan Ellison called Soldier from Tomorrow. A later letter column apologised and said that a credit for Harlan Ellison had accidentally been left off the issue by the editors. In 2011, Jim Shooter published his recollection of the incidents on his blog. He claims that Manklow passed off Harlan's story as his own and that the later apology for the editorial error was a legal manoeuvre. This is one case where the fact we don't have Manklow's own account leaves us unsure of the true story, because Jim Shooter is not always the most accurate reporter.
Reliable.
Yeah, I mean, everybody has their own version of a story, and you'll get the best story if you get both sides. And the unfortunate thing with Bill Manklow, because of his situation, is you only ever get one side. The other plagiarism allegation is slightly more complex. In issue 312 of Hulk, Manklow introduces the idea that Bruce Banner's split personality is related to him being abused by his father as a child. Now, this concept was due to be introduced in a Hulk graphic novel by writer-artist Barry Windsor-Smith. When that issue of Hulk was published, Barry Windsor-Smith felt his idea had been stolen and withdrew from the project. Now, some people talk about how Manklow was trying to do his job by incorporating elements of a spin-off into an ongoing series, and other people see it as a deliberate attempt to get him first. You know, with the idea to make it look like it was his idea, not Barry Windsor-Smith's idea. Obviously, it would be easier to decide where the truth lies if we could get both sides of the story, but we can't. Very interesting thing, though, about that Barry Windsor-Smith Hulk story is he's kept that story for years. He withdrew the work he'd done, and he's reworked it, and it's finally going to be published. Hopefully, at the moment, it's planned in for January 2021 by Fantagraphics Publishing. So I think that'll be really interesting to see. He's greatly expanded it from the original story. I know he's added a lot about Nazism, and it's more historical. But it sounds like it's going to be a fascinating story. So it'll be interesting to see what the original version was. So obviously, my personal introduction to Bill Manklow's writing was this very story, as it was reprinted in Marvel UK's Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Manklow had two runs on Spectacular Spider-Man. He wrote issues 9 to 42, then he left, went off and did other writing, and then he came back for issues 61 to 89. So obviously, this is a reprint of issue 81, so it's towards the end of his second run. His second run is best known for the creation of Cloak and Dagger. He did this in issue 64, and the other thing it's well known for is the development of the relationship between Spider-Man and the Black Cat, which again is part of this story. Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends was reprinting all the US Spider-Man titles, so I was seeing these, the Amazing Spider-Man stories by Roger Stern and John Romita Jr., and the Marvel team-up stories by J.M. DeMatteis and various artists at the same time as I was seeing this story. They were all reprinted in one book. And I loved these Manklow Milgram stories the most. Though Marvel UK was my first exposure to his work, I was too young to notice his name until I discovered Marvel US in 1986. And when I came in, he was writing two series. He was writing Cloak and Dagger, which I loved, which at the time when I first came into comics, it was the last couple of issues of that series. And then it was relaunched as half of a book called Strange Tales and another book called Alpha Flight. He was already, though, in the process of leaving comics. In the mid-80s, he enrolled in law school, and in 1987, he began working as a Legal Aid Society public defender in the Bronx. With the DC Invasion series that DC was publishing at the same time as this issue of Marvel Tales, Bill Manklow left comics. Since then, effectively starting with the comic we're covering today, his work has been almost continually reprinted. Manklow's writing is characterised by extreme melodrama and interpersonal drama ideally suited to superhero comics. He was also good at world building, creating involved and involving backstories for sci-fi characters. He was never the top writer at Marvel, says books were often drawn by artists who were either new or considered part of their peak. He would passionately support new artists and was the writer of some of the first stories by people who ended up being really big names, like Keith Giffen, Ed Hannigan, who was the co-creator of Cloak & Dagger, Michael Golden, who he worked with on Micronauts, Mike Mignola, who I've mentioned before, who went on to create Hellboy, Jackson Geiss, Rick Leonardi, who's one of my favourite artists, who did Cloak & Dagger, and Jim Lee, who's a huge name now and a publisher at DC. At the same time, he also had a long partnership with artist Sal Buscema and inspired him to produce some of his best work. And you already know from two episodes ago how much I love Sal Buscema. There have been a number of fundraisers over the years to support Bill Mantlo's care. Obviously, it's very expensive having 24-hour care, particularly under the US system. There is no current live fundraiser, but there are two ways that you can help him. One of them is the publisher IDW recently published the Michael Golden's Micronauts Artist Edition. That was published this year, and they're giving a percentage of the profits to Bill's care. There's also the Hero Initiative. It's a charity I would recommend anyone interested in comics gives money to every now and again, which raises funds to support comics creators who face financial difficulties, particularly caused by healthcare costs. And if you want to donate, go to heroinitiative.com and contribute. Okay, let's move on to look at the artists of this issue. So penciler Alan Milgram's career was covered in episode 2 of this podcast when we looked at Marvel Fanfare number 40, of which he was the editor. I don't want to repeat myself, but I wanted to say a little bit about why I love his art. Because I think before I wasn't really talking in detail, I just went through he did this and this and this. Because we weren't looking at his art. I think Al Milgram's pages burst with energy. Characters come out of the panels at all odd angles and shapes, and he uses idiosyncratic positioning. At times his art edges on ugliness, but it always grabs your attention. I love his art and I think he's greatly undervalued. So that's my piece on Al Milgram. Let's move on to the inker, probably more of a finisher on this because they're jointly listed as artists, and that's Jim Mooney. Now, Jim Mooney was one of the most prolific comic artists of the Silver and Bronze Age. So, do you know what I mean when I talk about the Silver Age or the Bronze Age?
Yeah, the times when people have said that it's kind of, you know, the best. And
yeah, it's kind of that. I mean, it does relate as well to kind of the Golden Age is the original comics. So, the original Superman, the original Captain America. Basically, kind of up to a few years after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
So the first flush of superhero comics. Then Silver Age is kind of the relaunch. So it's like when DC do Flash and Green Lantern, and they bring them back as new versions. And at the same time, you get Marvel coming up with Spider-Man and everything. Mm-hmm. That's the Silver Age. And then the Bronze Age, most people say, starts about 1974 and leads up to about the end of the 80s. So if you say someone's Silver and Bronze Age, you're basically saying their career goes from about 1950 to 1990-ish. They're kind of two 20-year periods.
Is there an age now, then?
People do discuss it. Some people call it the modern age.
Okay.
I've heard people call it, I've heard people talk about copper ages. I think the problem is, if you're trying to define an era, it's easier to do it afterwards.
Yeah, the people in medieval times didn't call it the medieval times.
Exactly. You know, they didn't know they were in the Middle Ages because what's in the middle of? You know, it's, and again, they didn't call the First World War the First World War until after.
Yes, until the
Second. There'd been another one. Mm. Yes. So, yeah, we're talking about, and actually I've called him one of the most prolific comic artists of the Silver and Bronze Age, but he actually goes before that. His earliest comics art was published by Fox Publications in 1940. So really, he did do Golden Age work as well. And he moved on to draw stories for various publishers on many different characters. First working for DC in 1946, where he was drawing Batman, but he was drawing Batman at the point when it said by Bob Kane. It never said by Jim Mooney on it. His most famous early work, and I call it early work, runs from 1959, so he'd actually been in comics for 19 years, to 1968, when he drew Supergirl for the best part of 10 years, and he was considered the most influential artist on her classic iteration. So he basically drew every Supergirl story for about 10 years. So he's best known as a Supergirl artist. In 1968, he was recruited to Marvel Comics because they wanted him to ink Amazing Spider-Man. He stayed with Marvel until the late 80s, drawing or inking almost every series, including loads of Spider-Man. I mean, this is a Spider-Man story, but he worked on every Spider-Man book at one point or another. And on most of them, he did some penciling, some penciling and inking. He really was all over it. He also did two runs that are very well regarded on two series, one called Man-Thing and one called Omega the Unknown, which were written by writer Steve Gerber. Jim Mooney's clean, classic, illustrative style made superheroes and heroines beautiful, and he continued to work until the late 90s, giving him a 60-year career in comics. He died in 2008 at the age of 88, so, you know, had a good life. Letterer Joe Rosen first worked for the production department of Fawcett Comics in 1940. He soon began to get freelance lettering work. He did draw a few romance comics in the 60s and 70s, but by the time he retired in 1996, he was considered one of the greatest letterers of all time. His work was clean, clear, and controlled. It was eminently readable, and he was hugely prolific. He lettered hundreds of comic books. He died in 2009, also aged 88. Now, the person I can tell you the least about is the colourist, Bob Sharon. He's someone I haven't been able to find a lot of information about online. His earliest work was in 1978, colouring for Marvel, and he continued to work continuously for Marvel until 2000. This included over 15 years colouring Amazing Spider-Man. He continues to produce art for the commission market and was a regular at comic conventions across the US until comic conventions had to stop this year. Can't imagine why. Weird one. Yes. Now, the editor, Tom DeFalco, he joined Archie Comics in 1972 as an editor and worked there through to the end of that decade. In 1981, he joined Marvel Comics, editing the Spider-Man titles until 1984. At this point, he was promoted to executive editor, which was the second in line to the chief, with responsibility for special projects. In this role, he oversaw the launch of G.I. Joe, the comic series, Secret Wars, and Transformers. He also launched the Star Comics line of comics for kids. In 1987, he took over as editor-in-chief and was in charge of Marvel for 7 years. Alongside his editorial career, DeFalco is a prolific writer. In the 70s, he wrote stories featuring Archie and also Superman comics, particularly Superboy stories. And then when he moved to Marvel in the 80s, he wrote a lot for them. Initially, he worked on the series Machine Man and Marvel 2-in-1, which was a Thing team-up book. And very soon after he left as Spider-Man editor, he took over writing Amazing Spider-Man. He then moved on to write huge runs on Thor and then Fantastic Four. When he left editorial, so when he stopped being editor-in-chief, he returned to writing Spider-Man. And then he created what was called the MC2 universe with Ron Frenz, which started with an issue of What If and led to a line of comics, which is most notable for the Spider-Girl book, which he wrote from 1998 to 2010. In the last 10 years, he's returned to Superboy and he's returned to Archie, both characters he first wrote in the 70s. Okay, so let's move on to our little description of the comic that we've read. So it's Marvel Tales, 220 Stalkers in the Shadows. We open at the Dannemora State Prison, where Boomerang and the Punisher are both imprisoned. Boomerang has managed to steal a spoon, which he shapes into a boomerang and throws at the mechanism that seals the cell doors. As the guards arrive, Punisher and Boomerang easily overpower them and escape, but the Punisher stops Boomerang and leaves alone. We cut to Peter Parker leaving his flat. A group of drug addicts is menacing his landlady, Mrs. Muggins, but Peter helps her scare them off. We see from above the vigilantes Cloak and Dagger have been watching them leave, and they confront them in an alleyway. We see Dagger fire her light knives at them, and Cloak envelop them in the shadow contained within him. Cloak and Dagger teleport away and leave the changed addicts. Dagger's knives have cured them of their drug dependency. Just then, an armed and dangerous Punisher jumps in to ask who their connection is. He's after the Kingpin, so he's working his way up to him. We switch to the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, where Spider-Man manages to get past police detective Captain Jean DeWolf to visit the Black Cat, who is injured from their battle with Dr. Octopus. Felicia Hardy is sleepy, so he swings out the window, brooding on his recent troubles as he goes. In particular, he is worried about the fact that the Black Cat seems to love Spider-Man, but may not love Peter Parker when he lets her know who he is. So she doesn't know yet that he's Spider-Man.
Ah, okay.
Or rather, she doesn't know who Spider-Man really is. As he's swinging over an abandoned tenement, his spider sense tingles to warn him of danger, so he enters and finds a number of beaten junkies and Cloak and Dagger. Spider-Man launches himself at them and they fight back. He tries to get a hold of Cloak and realises he's made of darkness and doesn't really have a body. In trying to fight them, Spider-Man ends up falling into the darkness within Cloak. We have seen already that people who enter his cloak face their fears and leave shaking and numb, but Spider-Man is able to leave unharmed. Dagger wants to team up again, but Spider-Man feels he can't team up with people who brutalise junkies. Dagger lights up the room to prove that they didn't hurt the junkies. Spider-Man can see the bullet holes left by the Punisher, and we cut to him on a roof hunting the Kingpin. And it ends, to be continued.
Message keeps getting clearer. Radio's on, I'm moving round the place. I check my look in the mirror. I wanna change my clothes, my hair, my face. Man, I ain't getting nowhere. Just living in a dark like this. There's something happening somewhere. Baby, I just know that there is. You can't start a fire. You can't start a fire without a spark. This gun's for high. We're just dancing in the dark. Love, yeah. You see, I'm getting older. There's a joke here somewhere and it's on me. Shake the world off my shoulders. Come on, baby, and it slaps on me. Come on, baby, and it slaps on me. Come on, baby, and it slaps on me.
Talk about this comic. So, did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it.
Shall we go through the characters and which characters you like? So, yeah. Spider-Man, you said you knew Spider-Man already. Did Spider-Man, did anything happen to him that you thought was odd or that was different to what you knew?
I was a little bit confused by who, why he was so confused or concerned for Mrs. Higgins or Miggins or what?
Mrs. Muggins.
Muggins.
Yeah, so, was. I mean, obviously this is the first time I saw Mrs. Muggins. But she becomes a big character. She's in there for quite a while in different Spider-Man stories.
Okay.
And she's always, like, chasing him for the rent because he hasn't really got enough money. And
He's
kind of half a student, but is he a student? He's given up being a student. He's trying to earn money. He's, you know, typical kind of Peter Parker, Spider-Man stuff. And she's always after him for rent. So it's quite odd for him to be on the same side as Mrs. Muggins.
Mm.
And she usually comes over as like this really angry woman saying, give me money.
Right.
And obviously at this point, she's kind of more sympathetic.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's odd. what is odd, we did talk about this before we opened it. Mm-hmm. On page 8, and I will share this picture online at mm-hmm. shouldilovethis.blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. There is a panel where she talks about the habit of the people who'd attacked.
Right.
Or were causing trouble in her place.
Sure.
And he goes, habit, and looks down, and there's nothing on the floor.
Okay.
Now, I checked that panel on Marvel Unlimited.
That's true.
Where, obviously, they have a reprint of the original.
Mm-hmm.
And on that, you can actually see a load of drug paraphernalia. You can see, like, yes. syringes and, you know, various other things. On the panel in this 1988 reprint, there's nothing there on the floor. So there's actually a panel where he looks down and reacts to something that isn't there, which is also quite interesting.
Yes, because I... Yes, when I saw that, it didn't really register. But I just imagined he didn't know what the habit was. Because
yeah,
he
didn't
see it. But obviously, if it's on the floor in the original panel.
You know, and there's something interesting in that, but between the original publication in 1983 and the reprint in 1988, which is only 5 years, they have decided to remove that element from the art. You know, that back in 83, they thought it was acceptable to show drug paraphernalia, but by 88, they decided it wasn't. Now, we don't know why. We were talking about this actually earlier. We went out for a walk because, like everybody, we're going out for walks every now and again during lockdown. And we were like chatting about the comic, and I was saying about how I found it interesting that they'd edited out drug paraphernalia in that time period and what could have caused that. And I mean, we don't know. It could be as simple
because...
as... I mean, 1988 really was kind of the Just Say No era. Which 83 was less so.
But then, wasn't there, so by 83, the Americans obviously had Reagan in. I vaguely remember Nancy Reagan sort of getting quite,
Well, she met the people from French Hill.
Into campaigns around drugs at the time as well.
But I'm wondering if that was a bit later
80s.
On. Yeah.
Maybe that was a bit of an 80s thing, because maybe he wasn't that concerned by the drugs epidemic at the time. Which I thought was quite good, because obviously, it again, I'm quite into place and how places are portrayed. And in the previous one, we did a whole thing around Birmingham and all that sort of thing. So here it's very much
like... That was
like
Liverpool.
Liverpool. See? Very good at this. And it's all very sort of like... So this is obviously New York. New York in the 80s and 70s, as we know, was in huge financial difficulty. So it's a kind of... realistic.
It was definitely considered more kind of criminal place, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a place where crime was happening more.
Yeah.
And it was talked... I mean, in some ways, it's still talked up as being a horrible crime place, even though that's less true now. But I think covering drugs, you can see... It's a very interesting conversation with comics, you know. There's a very famous case from the either very late 60s or early 70s, where there were two issues of Spider-Man, the original Spider-Man book, which was Amazing Spider-Man, where Harry Osborn, who's a friend of Peter Parker, his best friend and flatmate, gets involved with taking drugs. I think it's him, anyway. Somebody does. And in the thing, it's just a couple of pills. You don't know what the drugs are. And it's kind of an anti-drugs story. Now, at that point in time, the Comics Code Authority would not let you reference drugs in any way. So even an anti-drug story wasn't allowed. So Stan Lee decided to publish it without the Comics Code Authority. Now, they then changed the Comics Code Authority rules in the 70s. So by the time this is published, it's 1983, things have developed. You can show more things, could be more violent, you can have drugs in there, providing you're not saying drugs are good. So maybe that's part of why they put it in there in the first place. Bill Mantlo was a writer who who like to put real world stuff into his stories in some ways. I mean, his writing is not realistic in the sense that his dialogue is far from realistic. He's got a very heightened style. I think I described him as being very melodramatic. It's very comic booky.
Yeah.
But he liked bringing in real things. He liked bringing in, you know, drug issues. He liked bringing in political issues. He liked... And actually, when I found out, years later, not at the time that he stopped writing comics, but years later, when I heard the story about him going off and training to be a lawyer and working in a free clinic, you know, kind of doing human rights stuff, it made sense when I'd read a lot of his writing. And by that point, I'd read a lot of his Spider-Man stuff as back issues, or, you know, I'd read his Alpha Flight run, I'd read bits and bobs of his other stuff, because he was very prolific, and I don't think many people will have read all of it. But you can see he would have wanted to bring that social issue in. But the interesting thing is, obviously in 1983 they thought, oh, it's a good thing, put in the social issue. But by 1988 they're like, well, we can have the social issue in there, but we don't want the drug paraphernalia scene. It's got to be hidden. We don't show that, but we talk about drugs. Now, some of that, I think, will be the Just Say No. I think there is also a discussion that goes backwards and forwards about how just seeing it can be an encouragement to do it. People do say that. Yeah. I mean, if you look at Marvel Comics now, for about the last, I think it's about the last 10 years, you are not allowed to show characters smoking in Marvel Comics.
Gosh.
The guy who was editor-in-chief, Joe Quesada, he actually outlawed that, and apparently it was very specifically linked in his life to the fact that his parents died of cancer. It was a very personal thing, and he went, no, nobody smokes anymore. No villains, no heroes, no, there's just no smoking happens in Marvel Comics. You know, and decisions are made, and maybe that decision happened in between. Another thing that may have been involved is between 1983, I mentioned before, the editor of this comic at the time was Tom DeFalco. He edited that issue of Spectacular Spider-Man. 5 years later, he's the editor-in-chief of the whole of Marvel. Now, it's possible that he changed his mind about what was acceptable. I think it's also possible that he may have got some pushback on it. He was the editor, so he'd have known better than the writer. There were lots of letters complaining, or lots of, you know, groups phoning them up and saying, how dare you show drugs in my kid's comic? So it's possible that's why that was removed in between. I don't know. Definitely... By the late 80s, Marvel Comics, in some ways, become more conservative about social issues. Now, some of that may be just the way it's going. What, weirdly, particularly from a UK perspective, they become much more obviously violent.
Right.
So you see, you know, the Punisher is the key character on the cover now, because they're like, we want to show off that the Punisher's in this. Whereas on the original comic, he's not even on the cover. Right. There isn't even a little logo saying, plus, the Punisher is after the Kingpin. Not mentioned at all. So that's interesting. Now, the thing I thought might confuse you about Spider-Man is obviously you know Spider-Man. Everyone, I think, in the world knows Spider-Man. And you may know some of his girlfriends. You know, Mary Jane was in a lot of films. There were films with Gwen Stacy in them as a girlfriend. The Black Cat as his girlfriend is a character I don't think you must have come across.
No.
Felicia Hardy, who's the Black Cat. I thought maybe that would be the one that confused you. Not confused you, but that was just a bit surprising.
I'd forgotten about that part, and I wasn't... It seemed... let me have a look. It seemed like... it didn't seem to link to anything so far. So that's why I didn't really... I thought, oh, well, that's interesting, but I didn't...
I read it as an eight-year-old. And a key part of that storyline, and it continues after Bill Mantlo leaves the book.
Right.
So I say he's towards the end of his run. And I think what he replaces Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, with on his writing, like, sheet, on what he's doing, I think that gets replaced by the Cloak and Dagger series. So it makes sense that he would follow those characters who he's created and obviously loves into their own series. But one of the key storylines is the Black Cat-Spider-Man relationship. She was a character who first appeared in the late 70s in Amazing Spider-Man. But at this point in time, she only really appears in Spectacular Spider-Man in this series. She's in Amazing Spider-Man. You see him thinking, oh, I wonder if I should go out with this woman or spend time with Black Cat. How will she react? But you don't actually see her. You just see him thinking about her. And there's always like a little footnote saying, see Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man. So this relationship is about this book. And she starts off as a villain. And from her first appearance, she's interested in Spider-Man. She finds him attractive. And there's this gradual story where she kind of starts doing good things. Then she gets superpowers in various complicated ways, which you find out more about later. And it just moves on and moves on. And eventually, you know, she gets better from this. Eventually it gets to a point where he lets her know that he's Peter Parker. Which was a story that I read when I was 8 or 9 in the UK version. But it's all part of a gradual thing. And this was a key point where she decided to be a hero. And she took part in this fight against Dr. Octopus. Now, she gets injured because she's not as powerful a hero as Spider-Man. And then she's in hospital. So it's like this new thing that's happening.
Right.
And it's, in some ways, it's odd. It feels really weird nowadays. Because she's just a character that's always been there when you look at it now. But the amount of work that Bill Mantlo puts into kind of like trying to make it a bit real, you know, the idea that there could be, there's been a lot of female characters who he's had relationships with where they love Peter Parker and he's terrified to tell them that he's Spider-Man. So this is coming at it from the other way. She loves Spider-Man, but would she like Peter Parker? Because Peter Parker isn't as interesting as Spider-Man, apparently. The other thing I think interesting about this scene, if we mentioned a bit, is the police officer, Jean DeWolf, who's there, Detective Jean DeWolf, Captain or whatever. Captain, isn't it? Captain DeWolf. What I find very interesting is this is a story where the police are on the same side as Spider-Man and they're friendly. And so many Spider-Man comics, you read both like old ones from the 60s, new ones that are done today, Spider-Man often has quite an uncomfortable relationship with the police and with authority figures. And it's interesting that he went through this period in the 80s where he's friends with a police officer. You know, and particularly a police captain, so someone who can do it. So that's interesting, you know, that's an interesting change. Now that does change even more later on. And there's a very big story that particularly leads to a change in that. What else can we talk about? Let's talk about the guest characters. So should we talk about Cloak and Dagger?
Yep.
Now, I'm trying to remember what you asked me about Cloak and Dagger earlier.
So just their backstory, really. Which didn't seem sort of like, unlike other comics that we've read, didn't seem to bother me as much. I just took it for read that they had superhero...
I mean, there is the scene where they explain how their powers work, kind of.
Yeah.
It's there, but it's not as obviously there as some things are.
Surprise, it was a little bit of a surprise for me.
So the thing where her shooting the light knives stops people being addicts.
Yeah.
And makes them feel good. And the thing where going into the darkness of the cloak, they see their greatest fear. That's kind of introduced.
Yeah.
The fact that no one can escape from cloak, but Spider-Man can, which is interesting. I know, I was quite surprised rereading this, because you know sometimes if you've read something a lot, or you've seen it a lot, maybe with a film or a television thing, where things happen that don't happen, but they happen in your head? And I was convinced that on panel they say he can escape because he's a good guy and nobody else can escape because they're bad people.
Right.
And they don't say that, but that's been in my head since 1983. Which is interesting, isn't it? But they just set up, these are their powers, and there's a reference at one point that they fought together and that they teamed up versus a villain called Silvermane.
Right, right.
But actually, there's very little about the background of Cloak and Dagger in this issue. Particularly when you consider that they explain the background of Black Cat. They explain all the stuff about what's been going on with Peter Parker recently. He does the thing where he goes swinging across the city and he's thinking about all the other stories. He's going, oh, remember this story that I had the other week that was written by Roger Stern? And, you know, they're doing that kind of thing, but they don't do it with either Cloak and Dagger or with the Punisher, actually. They don't tell you that much about the Punisher in this story.
No.
Now, the interesting thing is the following issue, which I also have, that continues this story, and obviously I read in a Marvel UK reprint, goes over both the Punisher and the Cloak and Dagger origins. It reminds you. And actually, you can read it without knowing their origins.
No.
You can tell Punisher, he's a villain who's trying to escape, but he's a villain who kills other villains, and he's after the Kingpin. And the Kingpin is ultimately responsible for drugs. You know, that's what you find out. And you've got Cloak and Dagger, they're kind of half good guys, half bad guys. They don't like drugs. There's something going on there. You don't necessarily need to know anything else.
No.
There is a story there without knowing that. But it's a better story once you know more. And I think that's how, like, the classic Marvel comics draw you in as a reader.
Right.
You know, the fact that the comics are better if you read more comics. Is a key element. It's what makes you come back for the next issue and the next issue and the next issue and the next issue. It's that kind of inevitability, the momentum that you get, like, driven to the next and the next and the next. So is that all the characters? I think we've covered all the characters. We didn't really say much about Punisher.
What can you say about Punisher?
Well, do you know what I find interesting about Punisher? And I think it's because this was the first Punisher story I read. And then I read the, and I read it quite young, and then I read it again the following issue even more so. You get a bit where basically his thing is he doesn't like bad people. So he's after the villains and he thinks they should be shot. It's like a real extreme law and order thing. In the next issue, he's like shooting litterers and stuff. Like really extreme. Which later on they excuse away by saying he'd been drugged by someone in the stories. But I didn't see that story, so I read a couple years and years ago, you know, in 1983. Then about 1986, I start reading Marvel Comics, and he starts appearing again, and they're saying he's a hero. And I'm going, no, he goes around killing litterbugs. He's not my hero. And that kind of change of him from villain to hero is a fascinating thing about the times, I think. But also, you know, I found it really shocking, because to me, even when I was reading Punisher stories where theoretically he's the hero, I never stopped seeing him as the villain.
Yeah.
I wonder, you might be able to answer this, but maybe not.
Yeah.
But I wonder if some of that is just growing up, you know, in the 80s particularly, maybe less so now. But in the 80s, I saw the person who has a gun as the bad guy.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas maybe Americans don't see that because Americans are allowed guns. Guns are something the good guys have as well, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Going back to the 80s, it would be very rare to see a police officer with a gun. And we do now.
Yeah.
But even then, it's still quite rare in this country. But back in the 80s, I think I just saw this and thought, well, if you've got a gun, you're the villain. You know. So he was automatically a villain always. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just reading this story first at such a young age, and when I would have been more impressionable, just set me up. He's a villain. Cloak and Dagger and Spider-Man are heroes, and that will always be there. Whatever story I read, if I read a story where they're trying to say, oh, is Cloak and Dagger, are they villains?
Yeah.
I have to be like, well, no, they're heroes, because that's what I've got to say. I don't know.
Yeah. I think there's no question for British minds that the Punisher is a villain.
Yeah. But, I mean, genuinely, I think in 1983, when Bill Mantlo wrote this,
although he's trying to do good,
maybe, there was no doubt in the mind of the people making this comic that the Punisher was a villain.
Right.
I think there was no question of that in this story. I don't think it's just me. I think it's in the story. Yeah. He's a villain.
Then, but then that also comes down to our Cloak and Dagger villains as well, which is that thing that we were discussing on our little drawn earlier on. that there's...
Well, I suppose he's setting up, they're setting up in this story that Cloak and Dagger are on that line, are they heroes, are they villains?
Yeah.
So, In 1983.
It's...
By 1988, it's like, oh yeah, Cloak and Dagger, they're heroes. But now the Punisher's on that line because the line moved. That kind of idea of the Overton window, the idea of what's acceptable, moved through the 80s. That by 88, when this is being printed as a reprint, because the Punisher's really, really popular as a hero, or he's like the vigilante, he's on the edge. So what is on the edge has moved a long way in between those two eras.
So we'd like, so really that kind of, you know, that kind of Cloak and Dagger vigilantism is kind of quite new, I think, and or it's not necessarily new, but because it would be interesting to see what they do with it now, or what they would do with it now, because a lot of the time...
I mean, obviously, the part of the problem you have now is technology. The characters... Well, yeah, the technology, but also the characters were introduced in the very early 80s, so the characters are nearly 40 years old now.
Right, right.
Of Cloak and Dagger. So in Cloak and Dagger stories they do now, there's 40 years of continuity, there's 40 years of comics.
Yeah, yeah.
That get taken into consideration. And I think the reason that Cloak and Dagger end up being clearly heroes is that once they have their own stories, once Bill Mantlo does a Cloak and Dagger comic, you know, in the first four issue series he does, which I do have, is 100% about the backstories of these kids. And you can see that they are kids who've had a hard time, but they're actually good guys. They've got a reason to be angry with drug dealers because they're experimented on by drug dealers, so they go after them. And they're probably a little bit more aggressive than other heroes would be. But they're definitely heroes. You know, it ends up, it doesn't take many more stories before it becomes very, very clear that they are not on grey lines. They are definitely heroes. Now, some of that is about Bill Mantlo's writing, that he's developing them and going deeper and going deeper. So his original idea, possibly to be on that grey line... You need to be a little bit unknown.
Right, yes.
Once you know the depth of a character, it's easier to view them as a good guy because you know why they're doing... Even if they do something bad, you know they're doing it for good reasons. Maybe.
Yes, maybe. Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It's an interesting conversation about... Because obviously the way that media sets up for the idea of heroes and villains affects what we do as real people in the real world and how we respond to things. You know, we've seen that. I mean, 2020 is a year when we've seen that, when we've seen people shouting law and order, when we've seen things like Black Lives Matter protests on both sides of the Atlantic. We've had the protests in this country as well. There have been incidences in this country as well. It isn't just an American thing.
No, no.
And I think, you know, who do you give hero status to, who do you not, is interesting, and it says a lot about society. And I suspect the difference between 1983 and 1988, with the Punisher being he's probably a bad guy, but he's trying to kill other bad guys, so he's not as bad as the bad guy who's trying to kill good guys.
Yeah.
To him being a hero, I think probably the way that the 80s developed is a big part of that.
Yeah.
You know, the way that across media with things like your Dirty Harrys and your Die Hards. Was Die Hard by 1988? Well, it was in the ether. Yeah. Your Robocops, your idea of the action heroes, your Rambos, that kind of level. And at the same time, you've got an incredibly right-wing media, you've got a lot of...
So basically, I think we're saying that...
Like, the religious right's very powerful in lots of countries. There's a lot of pushback against previous gains on the left. You know, we spoke last time about the AIDS crisis, how that pushed back homosexuality, equality for gay and lesbian and bisexual people. you know, we saw, you know, feminism kind of took a step back in the 80s. It was kind of a retrograde step in some ways, or at least I would view it as that. I mean, not everybody would agree with us. But maybe that's a big part of him moving from being a villain who's trying to do some things that some people would see as good to being a hero over that 5-year period. It's an interesting conversation. And it's interesting that what in many ways is a very kind of classical superhero comic that's very good and evil, brightly coloured, very traditional, gets us to talk about these deeper things.
And also I think what's quite interesting about it is that maybe traditionally in comics there's a sort, you know, there's a good and the bad, and sort of by this point there was a bit of nuance and
yeah, a bit of grey tones to it, yeah,
a bit more questioning of what is good and what is bad, which is probably something.
Well, that, I mean, I do, you know, I find myself slightly, you know, I have quite a leftist viewpoint, as you know, as I'm sure people listening can probably guess if they've listened.
I hope so.
To all the episodes, I think it's quite obvious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I read this when I was 8. You know, this was one of the first things that I read that I sought out myself. That I read without being given it by a school or without, you know, and this is inside me. And this story was inside me. When I read this in 1988, I went, wait a minute. And it's only in, like, maybe the last 3 years that I've been able to do online research, that information has been there for me to go, this is that same comic. To be able to find pictures of, like, the UK version of it and be able to see what it looked and go, yes, that's the comic I had. I remember that spinner that was stuck to the front of it. I remember getting the stickers. I remember, you know, to be able to pick, because I don't have those initial lot of comics, to finally know that, yes, I definitely read this as a kid makes this very special to me. And this means this is one of those comics. When we say, should I love this comic? If we had read this and said, oh, that's a pile of crap, you shouldn't love it, I would still love it.
Yeah.
Because it is so foundational to my fandom for comics. You know, I read it at such an impressionable age. And it was like, it made me love Spider-Man. And it made me love Cloak and Dagger. And I gave up on Spider-Man within a year and started buying The Return of the Jedi weekly.
Okay.
But then they did, one of the backups in there was a series called Power Pack. And at one point, Cloak and Dagger turn up in Power Pack.
Oh.
And, you know, by then I'm about, I don't know, 10, 9, 10? Probably 10, maybe even 11. And I was so excited to see these characters who I didn't have the comics anymore, but I remembered them and I loved the idea of them. You know, and I think that then made me buy some Cloak and Dagger comics that are a bit crap because I love them so much from this. But I think this is a good comic. What do you think? Should I love this comic?
I think you should. Sort of like, I think it's got some really nice, interesting artwork in it.
Do you know what? We didn't speak specifically about the artwork.
No.
I mentioned at the beginning about Al Milgram's stuff being kind of all angles and limbs everywhere. And at times being a bit ugly. And what I find very interesting about this run of issues, where he's working with Jim Mooney. Jim Mooney, I said, is known for making superheroes beautiful. Al Milgram's kind of known for making superheroes ugly. And that meld, where you've got kind of the crazy arms, but then you've got the beautifulness put on top. You know, the way that Jim Mooney finishes characters, and I don't know, there's something about, I mean, I'm not an expert on art, but the way that he puts his lines down, everything looks so clean and so precise, but also it's got an illustrative quality. It feels expressive always. Sometimes if things are clean and precise, they're also kind of angular and rote or mechanical. Whereas his stuff's very lush, it's very naturalistic. And I think the two of them combined make a perfect team. And don't forget, I saw this first on a UK comic, which is bigger.
Oh, okay.
and a lot of the pages would have been black and white. They used to Marvel UK comics at the time, about a third of it was colour, so exactly the same as the American. About a third of it was black and white, and about another third would be black and white, but with just one colour.
Right.
So it would be black, white and blue, or black, white and yellow, or black, white and red.
Yeah.
So they would just have, like, one of the colours on there, and the rest of it would be black and white. So, you know, the art, I think, seeing it bigger... I mean, I remember copying pictures from this.
Right, so you draw...
You know, particularly... I very much remember the bit where Dagger's got her arm up, and she's lighting up that room of all the people lying over the sofas in kind of the crack den.
Okay.
It's not a crack den, because I think they're implying heroin, aren't they?
Well, because the end... Sort of like, you're led to believe at one point that...
Well, you're led to believe they've all been shot.
Yeah, then we discover that they're all victims of drugs.
Well, no, I mean...
No?
They're knocked out. It actually says, there's something like Cloak says something about how they got hit by tranquilizer bullets. He calls them mercy bullets or something. There is a thing.
Oh, you mean...
So he's not... They haven't been shot with real bullets. So this, again, may be an editorial thing. It may be that Bill Mantlo and Al Milgram intended it to be bullet holes. And then they were like, do you know what? That's a bit harsh. You know, there's all these bodies lying here. There's bullet holes everywhere. Let's say that they were mercy bullets, that they were... No, I think it's further down. I think he mentions each... Yeah.
Okay.
What's the phrase?
Each shell contained a powerful and painful sedative. Mercy bullets.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe they've rewritten it so that they're not all killed. Because they thought that would be vicious. Okay. And interesting, you know, and again, a very early 80s in particular comic trope, is to have lots of dead people, no blood.
Yes.
No blood at all. Blood was... And actually, you see a change happen from about 85 onwards, where suddenly there's blood everywhere. Right. And then initially, if you see blood, it's always just black coloured in.
Yeah.
And eventually they get to the point where they can, like, make it pink or purple. And then eventually, you know, by about 1993, there's, like, the brightest red, the same colour as Spider-Man's costume, everywhere in comic. It's... That kind of thing's
so
a bit weird.
What's the battle report, then, at the very level?
Well, that's the idea of that he keeps a log of his battle. So, again, with the Punisher, he's keeping a log of his battle, and he's written, tonight I will kill the Kingpin.
Okay.
And he's saying, battle report. Now, what's quite interesting with that is that is something that develops.
Card.
Yeah, it's on, like, a little file card. But as that becomes, in later comics, they talk about the Punisher War Journal, which ends up being a title for a Punisher spin-off book.
Okay.
But, you know, 5 years later, he's writing it in his war journal.
Okay.
And then that becomes a thing. So to read that, actually, I didn't mention it in the thing, but where he says battle report number, what is it, 500-89?
Yeah.
That moves to, you know, being war journal entry with a date. You know, that's kind of the development of the Punisher. And that stood out to me, but I didn't think that was worth...
It's interesting to say that it's on... He's not actually writing it, so he's just saying it, or he's thinking
it. Yeah, he's kind of saying it out loud, but I think the concept is he's meant to write it down afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, it's... I mean, one of the things... The following issue talks a bit more about his origin.
Right.
Might be the issue after that, actually.
Okay.
But the concept being that... He was a Vietnam veteran.
Right.
And he returned from Vietnam and his family got killed.
Right.
So he's kind of like a soldier. So there's always this kind of soldierish element where he's kind of like looking back and it's a war journal that you might have if you were a soldier.
Okay.
So anyway, shall we leave this here? We have to establish. Should I love this comic? Yes,
yes
I should. Yes. And I do love that comic. And yes. Thank you very much for joining me for this, darling.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, this is our November entry, so next episode we are going to be doing our December episode. Mm. And our December episode is going to be Christmas themed, oddly.
Surprisingly.
And I've even decided what our January one's going to be, because it's the new year.
Oh, surprise.
I have picked out a comic about some new characters. So it's got the word new in the title.
Oh, I wonder what that could be.
Well, there's quite a few, actually.
Oh, okay. Shall we let them
write in the... Yes, have a guess. If you want to comment on this podcast or guess what we're going to cover as our Christmas comic... Or recommend a Christmas comic to other people.
That has new in it.
Exactly. That has... Well, it doesn't have to have new. That's a separate one.
Oh, is it? Okay.
So the new is the New Year one. I thought, for New Year, what can I do? I was trying to think of a comic that was set on New Year's Day, and then I was like, I've had enough of that.
Okay.
So I decided one called New.
Okay.
Yes, and I've picked it.
Okay.
Very exciting.
It is very exciting.
But no, let us know what new comics you think we should cover. And also what Christmas comics you love. I've picked one that I think is maybe a little less well-known than some. It's quite exciting, but one that I love, obviously.
Of course.
But come back later and see, help us decide, should I love this comic? See you soon.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.